Let me start by talking about the book as what I call my personal adventure story. So rather than telling you it's a great intellectual scientific treatise, it really came about because I wanted to do it. And aside from what's up there, when I started the book project, I broke all the rules. I didn't know what I was going to write about. I didn't know the answers. And more importantly, I didn't know the questions. And that's one of the prerogatives of somebody who's old. You don't have to worry about doing real work. And for some reason, MIT Press figured I would come up with something. So this is some of my background. And the critical thing is something was missing, the big picture. As the introducer mentioned, I've had a long career. I've been president of society. Started Digital Audio as a random accident at 3 in the morning. And I've just been around. In fact, when I was really young, they thought I was a hippie rebel when I became president, and they were petrified I'd destroy the society. In any case, the book really is the central question of what is the question? And I'm going to focus on that. And in doing the research for the book, a couple things came out of it, and there are a couple critical ones. One of them is the perceptual uncertainty principle, modeled after Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And I'll give you sort of the answer. I'm going to run out of time because I've got about 5 hours of material to present. The perceptual uncertainty principle says, with regard to perception, those perceptual phenomena that you can study, the results are only weakly applicable to the real world. And those important phenomena in the real world are almost impossible to study because they don't fit the scientific paradox. So one of the paradoxes you have is, do you study things for which you have a method, or do you study things that are important but which you have no method? And that's one of the outcomes. The second outcome is this last one, which is also very critical, formal science versus folk science. And if you look at both science and art or folk wisdom or whatever you call it, you discover they have different assumptions and they can have different insights, and each one of them has half of the story. And the question is, how do you put them together? And then the middle issue, what happened to my, did it really die? No, okay. How to reconcile different perspectives. When you start the research, you discover everybody's got a different take on the auditory reality. And they don't necessarily agree. They speak different languages. What are you going to do with this massive quantity of material? Okay, now you can also hear me. We've got to. All right, so let's continue on. Now, I start with this talk as the premise that an audio engineer may think of himself as an engineer, as a scientist, but he forgets he's also an artist. And the question is, how do you reconcile the art issues and the scientific issues? In particular, the audio engineer is effectively, without his ever realizing it, a musical instrument designer. And we'll get to that. He effectively selects where the listener's going to sit. He acts a bit like the musical conductor, where he controls musical blending. He's creating an experience most of the time for which there is no original. The question then is, who decides what and why? And while each of you thinks the various responsibilities are clearly delineated, when you actually bore in and look very carefully, you discover that most of the oral experiences in our culture are created by committees. No one person owns the reality. And let me, I'll get a hang of this. Okay, now, the next part of this thing, I am going to run out of time, so I'm going to speak fast, is there's a bilateralness which people don't really respect. As audio engineers, we're considered concerned with sound, and we're often concerned with the sources. And if you look carefully, you say, you know what? Space changes our experience of sound. Now, that's sort of well known in this community. But there's the converse that people tend to ignore. Sound changes our experience of the space. In other words, the bilateralism comes about because sound and listeners never exist outside of a space. There is no such thing as a space-free listening experience. Regardless of whether you want to focus on the sound sources or you want to focus on your equipment, you can't escape the fact that human beings are someplace. Everybody's got to be someplace, and the sources have to be someplace. They change the sound. But for those people that are not purists, what you also then discover is the sound gives you the experience of the space. And sound, to use the visual analogy, illuminates the space and allows you with your ears to experience the geometries, the objects, the materials, all the physical aspects of the space can be experienced with the ears. So that you have this duality, which is often forgotten in the audio engineering sense. Okay, the next thing is, there's been a lot of research done on perception in this community, a lot of research done on acoustics. And if you look at that research, what you discover is it all has a scientific engineering flavor. It uses the language of physics. It uses the language of acoustics. It's a very clear language. What's missing is what's the experience of sound. Now, I don't mean perception in the sense of can you hear the change in reverberation time. I don't mean is that reflection detectable. What's the human experience? How do you talk about human experience in its own language? And it doesn't have a scientific language. You can build a translation between the scientific language and the experiential language, but experience fundamentally is not a scientific issue. In doing this work, I came up with five concepts of the experience of space. Now, I didn't call it space because it isn't space, and I called it spatiality. These are the five, and to some extent, we'll have time to get through most of them. I'm going to focus on musical spatiality because that's probably the most familiar to you. But in fact, there are at least five, maybe six or seven. How you navigate in a space with your ears, symbolism, icons, earcons, how the space changes your social relationships and psychology, how it adds to your aesthetic well-being. These are all components of it. It's not just acoustics. Okay, now let's focus on musical spatiality just to give you a feeling for the difference between acoustic space and spatiality. I've been in the reverb business for a long time. I am not the world's expert. I am not the world's expert on concert hall acoustics or music or any of these things. But when you look real carefully, it says, what's the experience of spatial acoustics from music? And it turns out, as best I could tell, there are only two dimensions. Now, from an acoustic analysis point of view, as we heard from Leo Baranek last night and others, there may be dozens or even hundreds of physical measures. But what is the basic experiential dimension? There are two. One of them is the reverberation spreads the sound in time, so-called reverberation decay. So you get temporal spreading. And temporal spreading as a dimensional concept really is an extension of the musical instrument. It's another resonance that gets tacked onto the musical instrument. So a clarinet being played at the beach has no spatial resonance. You play it in a concert hall, it has another resonance. Now, you don't call it part of the musical instrument because the musician can't carry around a secondary resonance. And in fact, unlike an ordinary instrument where the musician can select it and play it and modify it and do all kinds of things, the secondary resonance of his instrument he inherits when he walks into the space. Now, all these traditions came about through historic accidents. And that's in my chapter 3, which I look at the history of oral architecture. One of the patterns that shows up across the centuries and across the cultures is almost all aspects of the oral experience of space were accidents. Social accidents, random accidents, cultural, political. There was never a real oral architect. And one of the questions that sort of drifts through the book is, why don't you have oral architects, people who design spaces for the oral experience? There's a group in Finland who's coined the concept of sensory architecture, that we experience space through all our senses. But in fact, in our decade or our century, we live in a tradition of visual dominance. And visual dominance suggests that we don't experience spaces in any other way except looking. And there's some brilliant work done on that. Okay, so you got temporal spreading. Now, temporal spreading, which is an extension of the musical instrument, which is an extension of the performance operation, doesn't need anything other than mono. You can do temporal spreading just fine with a monophonic. The second element is spatial spreading, that you get listener envelopment, real reverberation, let's say in a great cathedral. Sound comes from all over, and I'm going to jump the gun for fear of running out of time. The essential property of enveloping sound, this is theory, I can't prove this is correct, is if you look back from an evolutionary point of view, one of the major functions of your ears was to identify and localize predators and prey, And it was very important to know where something was happening. And even today, modern man, if you're driving along and you hear the sirens, you really want to know where they're coming from. Are they coming from behind you, from a side street? Should you stop, pull over? And if you can't tell where something is coming from, you get anxious, highly attentive. And in the musical sense, I postulate or state that enveloping sound is oral caffeine. And musicians, composers, listeners like it because it's a stimulant. Now, notice you get two completely different dimensions out of one physical process. And there's a long tradition as to why you would have a concert hall. And it didn't come about because of its musical value. It came about to keep the rain and the wetness off of the listeners. It came about because you wanted to separate them from the noise of the donkeys running down the street. And eventually it got bigger spaces because you wanted to get more people in there. And that's another theme that shows up throughout history, is the dominant aspect of the design process, where there was a design process, had to do with the sweet spot. And you've all heard that concept, but the social significance of the sweet spot determines the space. How many people are in the sweet spot? How big is it? And so you look at a lot of the modern research on binaural and transaural, and however elegant it is, from a social point of view, it has one artifact. The sweet spot will hold one person. And if you look at something like Boston Symphony, which is considered a great hall, the argument is it has a relatively large sweet spot that includes maybe two-thirds of the audience. And as you look through all the technologies and all the implementations of the experience, the question to ask is how many people can enjoy the experience? And that becomes one of the central dimensions, all the way going back to the Greek amphitheaters and to the iPod generation. Shifts in attitude about how big the space should be determine the space. And the iPod space is a space of one. The Greek amphitheater was literally a space of 20,000. Okay, then you get modern music as opposed to the classical tradition. Musical rules of space and electroacoustic music, they don't subscribe to the notions of the 19th century and 18th century. They have their own rules. And maybe in another 50 years, those rules will dominate. They have a different way of looking at space because they have other freedoms. They have equipment and methods to manipulate spatiality without manipulating space. And while some of the purists who enjoy Bach and Beethoven and Mozart would cringe in their seat, in fact, all of us participate in the artificiality of it. You know, you mentioned the EMT 250. I do have to put one piece of humility in there. It may have been a great design. It may have been a classic. But for reasons that have nothing to do with what I did, most of the design process was trying to fight the limitations of technology and the economics. We made hundreds and hundreds of compromises to try to get something plausible into that box at a time when technology was very expensive. There were 400 integrated circuits in that. You look at a modern reverb, you got three. The cost of that was $25,000. The cost of the equivalent today is zero. So we were fighting economics. Why did it become a classic? And it's not for the reasons they described, and I'll get to that in a moment. And so you get another phenomenon. So let's keep going. This is a quick illustration of the temporal spreading. A clarinet can't play a chord. If you play a clarinet, play three notes from major chord in a highly reverberant space, you get a chord because the reverberation hangs around. You get the three notes blending, and you get the chord-like experience through the secondary resonance that could not have occurred had the clarinetist been in the beach. So the temporal spreading has a musical meaning, and the person in the recording studio controls that musical meaning. The clarinetist doesn't. Okay, and let me illustrate that for the moment. I did these slides basically for the audio engineers. If you look at a bunch of notes in sequence A through F, and I've shown you in red the reverberation from note A, you can see note B is blending with a certain amount of the red pitch that's coming through. C, and then by D, there is no more blending. It's gone. This red-shaped curve is controlled by the reverb box, the spatial synthesizer, either by the designer, in the case of the 250, because you couldn't control it, but in a modern box, the kind that you would get from, you know, Lexicon, you can control the shape of that red curve. You're controlling the musical blending of the pitch from note A with B and C. Here you've changed the shape of the red curve. Now you get much more blending of the red pitch with note D. None of this is under control of the composer or the musician or even the conductor. All of this takes place in the recording studio. And that takes place as a result of what the audio engineer designer did in the box, how to select the presets. He is controlling the musicality of the experience in ways he never really thought of. He needs good ears. So already you see the performance is now distributed throughout the chain. It's not simply an original performance. Okay, this is just a quick review. I'm going to sort of just sonic events. There's a whole class in the book which takes the reverberation spatial stuff and starts analyzing it in a musical language, especially in view of the modern language. And what you suddenly realize is the concept of reverb really disappears. You have dimensions of primary and slave event. Which event, like you hit the drum, that's the primary event. The space responds, that's a secondary event. You can decouple them. You don't have to connect them. You have localized versus diffused. If you're sitting in the middle of a chorus with people all around you, it's diffused in the same way that reverb can be diffused. These are musical dimensions which an audio engineer should be aware of, not because he's a musician, but because he's part of the whole process. Okay, here's Boston Symphony. This is classic, and this is the kind of reference that people have in their head when they think of a musical space as first class. And it itself was an accident. It was not on purpose. I mean, I know there's a lot of brilliant people who made the right decisions, but it really goes back to, you know, the Gewandhaus in 1700, which itself goes back further. And all these things were copied, and we'll get to in a moment the fact that there's a long tradition of duplicating whatever existed before. Okay, now here's an alternative space that Stockhausen had a bunch of performances in the Yedda Caves, however you pronounce it, in Lebanon. And one of the interesting, there's a long discussion that I've lifted that's in the book, but it really, there's a lot of discussion about the etherealness of the experience. One of the things about this space is everybody's very far from the musical instruments. They're only hearing reverb. It's entirely in the, what you might call the slave event. There is no direct response. There's just reverb. This is sitting in the reverb of the experience. Now, you could do that in the recording studio just fine. You could take your music recorded with dry microphones, pump it into a reverb, set the reverb up, kill the direct, and you could listen to an entirely different kind of spatial experience which Stockhausen composed for and performed in this space. Now, here's another spatial experience. This is in England, the so-called Beast, which I can't remember what it stands for. It's just a bunch of loudspeakers scattered around and a bunch of signal processing to create the experience entirely electronically. Now, a purist might say, why would you want to do that? But if you think about it, they created the symphony halls because that was the only technology they had. We have other technologies which we can use in other ways to achieve similar effects. And there's nothing that says that the old technology has to be the only way of doing it. Old technologists had only one way of doing it. And just as 50 years from now, there'll be other ways of doing it. So while you may be focused on the specifics, you've got to understand enough of the philosophy to know how to adapt to the shifting technologies and shifting options. You don't have to if you don't want to, but the cultures tend to move on. Just to further illustrate the fact that there's an underlying theme which shows up in the book, and that is cultural relativism, which says everything that we think are absolutes, if you really look at them very carefully, turn out to be culturally relativistic. When I listened to Leo last night and all his compatriots, of which I am one and I love Leo dearly, there's a sense, although he knows better, that what he says is a truth. And he doesn't recognize that he's putting out the truth of half the story and he's skipping the other half. And let me reframe what Leo is basically saying. He's saying, I have taken those halls that people love and think are great, and I've measured them and analyzed them and studied them until I know why they're great. Now, what he should have said is, I know the properties of those spaces that the subculture that I'm interested in calls great. So to use an analogy, I could say the French cooking style of the 1970 was loved dearly, and I could study why people loved it. But in fact, in the year 2005, They don't consider that cooking style the best. They have other cooking styles with other reasons why they prefer other things. I could study those and figure out why, what they have in common. So analyzing what something has in common for the properties of what people prefer is not the same thing as saying, what do people prefer? And this is a very interesting period. The 1930s, which went on for about 15 years, acoustics was poison for these people. Absolute poison. They hated anything that had acoustics in it, and they, killing the acoustics was like killing unwanted hostile noise. Dry was better. Driest was best. The Radio City has some thousands of tons of fiberglass acoustic material, lots of loudspeakers, a reverberation time that's 0.000, I'm exaggerating. It is totally dead. This was considered the best possible hall of this period. The music recorded in NBC's Studio H is absolutely brittle dry, and they loved it. Okay, you could say they were stupid, but they weren't. They were a subculture like our subculture that had preferences. And if you go back to the period of the kings and queens in France who listened in their chambers, they had their preferences. They had their idea. They would not have wanted a violin in that space. It was, they didn't like it. They had other instruments that they would have used, viols and other softer instruments. Each culture has its preferences. We're not, as audio engineering, we're not determining what people will like other than through the marketing and manipulation process. We can measure the properties of those things they do like. But that isn't to say the same thing as I can prove they will like it. And in that respect, the reason I bring that up is the EMT 250 was a total accident. But it was first, people got accustomed to it, it became familiar, and one of the patterns you'll see throughout history is familiarity is quality. And I'll do a digression. I know I'm wasting my time here. I happened to spend a lot of time in Europe and England in the, I think it was the early 70s, late 60s. And it, just about that period, there was a big scandal that broke in England. For a period of about 8 or 10 years, all the major European wine importers in England were taking their bottles of French wine and they were cutting it with enormous quantities, high percentages of Algerian junk wine, literally junk wine. And so they had this mixture that they had essentially bastardized the French wine. They were putting it in the bottles, labeling it, charging high prices. This went on for years. And the public assumed that's what the highest quality French wine is. When the scandal broke and these guys were stopped and they started importing French wine, the universal reaction of the population was, what did you do with our highest quality, best French wine? Why did you take it away from us? It took years of adaptation before they become acclimated to, quote, the real thing. That's why the EMT 250 is still a classic. It was first, and people got used to the taste of it. They began to associate that sound with the highest quality, and it's still, you know, a revered product, not for its intrinsic value. If I came out with the EMT 250 today for the first time, I wouldn't even get off square zero. That's humility speaking. That's what you get from age. Okay. Now, this slide says that you don't control your culture. As audio engineers, you may love quality. The listening experience, not the temporal spreading, but the spatial spreading, is controlled by these environments. These are a bunch of kids who are listening with headphones. Here's a dormitory. Somebody identified this, and I can't remember. It's a famous large cavernous railroad station in Europe somewhere, and I can't remember the name of it. Here's an elegant, upscale, you know, $100,000 living room. You don't control what these people will do. These are your culture. These are your stakeholders. They buy your equipment and your music, but you don't control their environment. You don't control their listening space. And that's where the humility in this thing. You're part of a long chain. You've got to be aware of what your constituents are doing. You can't design systems that don't fit the lifestyle of the people that are going to buy it, unless, of course, you're working for an academic institution and paying tuition. Okay, now, this I alluded to this. Quality is familiarity. Everybody knows the Boston Symphony Hall is one of the five best halls in the world. Everyone knows. That means the composer, the conductors, the musicians, and the aficionados will rate Boston Symphony that good. They love it. This is the constituency. Now, in fact, if you look at the reviews of the hall when it first came out, it was universally criticized as being dreadful. And there are explanations for why. But in fact, they disliked it. Like the French wine, the Boston Symphony Hall replaced the Boston Music Hall. And that had a completely different sound signature. It was completely different. They loved that French wine. And when they replaced it with the Boston Symphony, they said, ugh, what did you do with our French wine? And it took years for that hall to get, quote, seasoned. Now, people said, well, maybe the wood aged, maybe they filled up the orchestra with more people. But in fact, familiarity is everything. Gershwin, I love this. There's a whole book on what happens when you do something new in the art forms and what the reaction. This is a quote from that book. It was called Nauseating Claptrack, Vulgar and Inane. Every one of the major composers that we think are great was initially considered junk and garbage when they first came out. People don't like something new. Familiarity and quality are very tightly coupled. Shakespeare's Globe Theater, it's, quote, great acoustics. It was a copy of the bear-baiting arenas. That's what they understood in that period. There was nothing designed in there. They adapted it, but it was a replication of something that they had around. And again, we come back to the size of the sweet spot is determined by cultural expectations. And that theme goes over and over again. So when I read in the journal about somebody who's got this exquisitely elegant transoral system that requires you to set your living room up in a certain way, has one seat where you can get this brilliant effect, I say, well, this may be intellectually interesting, but there's no way the culture is going to accept it, unless, of course, you're designing it for people who have so much money they don't know what to do with it. They got a house with 18 living rooms, and they can certainly devote one room for this purpose. But the rest of us don't have that prerogative. Okay, this is one of my favorites. And to show you in the model, I can't use this slide except here publicly because they wanted an unbelievable amount of money to publish this particular picture. But it's very important to understand. This is an Escher picture. And the reason I put this up is I can't illustrate it acoustically, but this is visual spatiality without space. There are clearly doors, windows, staircases, people walking around. And if you take a quick look at it, you say, yeah, that's a space. But in fact, there's no possibility that's a real space. You could never build that or experience that. If you listen to modern music as it's come out of the recording studio, they have done Escher pictures on the space. There is no such thing as a space in which that music was created. You can't have a space that's simultaneously large and small. You can't have spaces shrinking and the walls changing their materials. You can't have a single orchestra where the soloist is close to you and then further away. All of these things are artistic creations. Now, you might say it's impure to have artistic creations like that because it doesn't match what would have been true in the 19th century. But art doesn't respect 19th centuries. It basically has its own rules of experience. Okay, here are the philosophical dilemmas that I experienced when I was doing this, and everybody in the professions has to. What are the questions? What methods can you use to answer them? What are the assumptions and axioms? I had a funny experience. I was part of a major research group at one of the major universities, and I won't tell you the name of it to protect their humiliation. And a great group of people, and it has to do with hearing. And so I'm going to lunch with them many times and with a bunch of postdocs and graduate students. And I asked one of them, you guys ever taken a course in epistemology and philosophy of science and how you know what you know? And the universal answer is, what are you talking about? I never heard of the subject matter. In other words, none of us in our modern culture with our fragmentation have any appreciation for the philosophy of science. How do you know what you know? And oddly enough, the lawyers have studied this subject extensively. They have a very clear set of rules of how you know what you know. But if I were to ask a typical scientist or engineer, and a scientist should know, they don't have a clue as to which assertions are legitimate and which ones aren't. What are the assumptions? And that was one of my favorite topics. Another one which you get is hidden agendas undermine rationality. Engineers love to think of themselves as rational, logical. Okay. They're human beings. They live in the culture. They participate in life like everybody else. Rationality is only one piece of their neural cortex. You're not capable. A computer can be rational. You can program the if-thens. Human beings are not computers. They have all kinds of agendas, and most of their personal agendas are not socially acceptable. So you never talk about them. You don't even talk about them to yourselves. There is no intellectual truth that's separate from the humanness of our existence. And so I turn to this audience and say, how many of you, and you're sitting there in your profession, recognize the humanness of your personal values and cultures completely undermines your pretense at logic and rationality? And that's why I wrote this book as a travelogue, an intellectual adventure story. And wherever I needed to fill in the gaps, I filled them in. I was open about it. I couldn't take myself out of the book, and so I wrote this in the first person. You know, you can't pretend that there's an objective reality. There's my view and my way of looking at it with my biases, and I put all that in. And then I asked the question, how come other people don't do that? And that's sort of a rhetorical question. How am I doing on time? Halfway? Okay. Well, it's not too bad. I start talking faster and faster. Cultural relevance, evolutionary relevance. This one is a wonderful topic. We are how we live. We change our brain. Just to put a piece of humility, I was having dinner many years ago with one of my great colleague friends, Dave Griesinger and Leo Baranek, and they were sitting around talking about their experiences in a concert hall. And it suddenly hit me. These guys can hear things that I can't. I've been in this business a long time. There are a few things I can hear that they can't. But by and large, their brains work differently than mine. And they weren't BSing me. They were hearing nuances that I knew from other reasons were potentially audible. I couldn't hear them. And I dare say a lot of other people couldn't hear them. They have trained their brains. And I will get to a couple more slides, if I don't run out of time, about how all of us train our brains. I can remember when I was doing the 250, there was one ugly parameter, which was an ugly trade-off between producing an artifact and fixing a problem. If you went too far one direction, you didn't fix the problem. If you went too far in the other direction, the artifact was too strong. My late dear friend, Carlo Bader, who was golden ears, a musical type, really exquisite, major contributor to that thing, he came and helped tune that parameter. He set the parameter much higher than I did. I said, Carlo, people are going to object to it. You can hear the artifact. I can't hear the artifact. Now, I could hear it bigger than life. I had been working with this issue for 3 months. I could hear it, nuances. Anyway, we compromised and split the difference. 4 months later, the marketplace said, our equipment stopped working. We can hear this particular artifact. So we tuned it back again, issued a new release. 6 months later, the market said, my equipment just stopped working. I could hear this artifact. In other words, people change their brain. So unlike an electron whose properties remain constant over its lifetime, the humans don't. And some people have trained their brains to unbelievable levels of sophistication. Other of us are totally oblivious. You are how you live, and your constituents are how they live. Okay, auditory spatial awareness. We're sort of drifting into the other spatialities. Ordinary people can hear things. They can hear a house without furniture. You can hear a big winter storm. This is just to say, wait a minute, you can walk around and make sense out of your environment by its acoustics, not by how it changes the sound because you're worried about concert hall. Just you can hear the environment. And I'm not going to... You can read the book. Spatiality is not space. And these are some of the things that come out of the difference. What's the emotional and social experience of a space? Preferences are art. You season to taste. Our attitude towards salt is not static from one generation to another. Maybe you like the Stockhausen experience of total reverb and no direct sound. Maybe you come out of the 1930 tradition. You like 100% direct and no envelopment. You can't prove one is better than the other. And as you look historically, if you lift yourself out of your own culture, if you take yourself out of this room and say, where does my career, my life fit in this century, in this millennium across the world? How do I fit? And this is one of my motivations for the book. I took my career and said, how do I place it into the cosmic big picture? And everything varies. There is no constancy. And 50 years from now, our sense of quality, they'll laugh at us and say, those idiots, how could they think that was quality? Guaranteed.
and I don't know which things they'll object to. Space serves a social function, even with music. What's the social function of music? And that's also has changed over periods and cultures. This is an example as an anechoic chamber. I don't know if they're round anymore. How many people have actually been inside them? Yeah, a fair number. Okay. If you can remember the first time you've been in it, it's a really weird feeling because it's got a lot of properties that are unfamiliar. Most people, including myself, say, whoa, that is weird the first time you go into it. The point of that experience is you have a very clear expectations of what space should sound like. And the anechoic chamber breaks those expectations until you become familiar with it again. You can get nauseous. You can get sick to your stomach. You can get spacey. It just feels weird. Next part that comes out of this thing is notice the language I'm using. There is no language of sound. I said weird, queasy. I described my stomach. I didn't describe the oral experience. And one of the other themes that runs through this book is there is no language of sound, and maybe for neurologic reasons. Almost all your major words in the audio engineering vocabulary are borrowed, modified. They lose their concreteness because, in fact, you may not have a good wiring system between your language center and your oral experience of the environment. It may have been that nature decided it was too much potential for positive feedback. So one of the other things of why you don't study some of these things, you don't have the language. And when you listen to two experts talk, they do it by inference, by nuance. Oh, that seat sounds like this other seat in this other space. Do you remember? Oh, yes. And when I stood up, I got that brittle feeling. Well, brittle is a borrowed word. Clear, transparent, warm, soft, intense. These are all. Look at your vocabulary and look carefully at it, and you'll discover it's not a natural vocabulary. Okay, oh, we've already been here. These are the five kinds of spatiality. You can look at the book. Obviously, I don't have time. Navigational. This is one of my favorites. These are some of the things you can hear. You can hear the size of a closet, the volume of a cave, an open doorway. I used to do an experiment in my class and have a student close his eyes and walk towards the wall and stop when his nose was 6 inches from it. Everybody laughed at me. 80% of the students could do it on the first try. Almost everybody could do it after a little bit of practice. Now, these are teenagers who are blind. They are riding their bicycles in the mountains of California. There's a whole tradition among a certain subset of blind individuals who navigate entirely with their ears. They can hear space. There was one person that was discovered in the 50s who was blind who could identify the shape of traffic signs by their oral signature. These are not sound sources. Anybody see the movie Ray Charles? Okay, if you remember, he alludes to it but doesn't actually say it. When he lost his vision, he swore to himself he was not going to have any of the baggage of blind people like canes and seeing eye dogs. He trained himself to navigate with his ears. He was determined not to do this. Ved Mehta, who was an Indian writer in the 50s, grew up in Calcutta where he was also blind. He used to jump around the roofs of buildings entirely blind. There are a subset of people who can use their ears the way we use our eyes. Now, contrary to what you would assume, blindness does not do anything to help your hearing. The population of blind people and sighted people have essentially the same auditory acuity. What then is the difference that explains this class of people? Well, it happens this group of people came out of a group run by Dan Kish, who is probably the only licensed teacher of orientation and mobility for the blind, who himself happens to be blind. And he, too, swore off all the traditional techniques. These people teach themselves to hear. Now, you and I could do this, too, but we have no incentive to try. And we have no incentive to invest the time in doing so. But anything you care about, you can learn to do. The brain is much more plastic, even at my age, there's much more plasticity than people know. You are how you live. These people are how they live. And even when they studied the peripheral auditory localization ability of conductors, they discovered it was much higher than the average population. They're sitting at the podium, and without turning their head, They want to know which violinist came in too early or too late. They don't want to have to turn their head. The note's gone. And they have trained themselves to hear nuances in the periphery of their auditory range. The converse is also true. People can be totally oblivious to everything they hear. The assumption that when you're measuring something psychoacoustically or perceptually, you're measuring humanity or truth, you're not. And one of my other hobby horses is in almost all the scientific experiments I've seen, they use the statistical technique of averaging. Well, averaging basically throws away all the variability. The essential issue is in the variability, not in the mean value. If you're looking for a star basketball player, you don't go into a city and measure the average height of 15-year-olds. The average height tells you nothing. To average obliviousness and golden ears to come up with something as mediocre, what's the point? And in fact, statistics, people lie with statistics, but one of the most common lies is averaging. What gives you the right to suppress what you're calling noise? It's not noise. Averaging came about from the physics community where there was uncertainty in the numbers due to random noise. And if it was an additive noise, the more you average, the more you can remove the noise. But human beings don't have variability because it's noise. There is no prototypical human, and anybody who deviates from that is simply noise. We're all different. And not only are we different, but we're not consistently different. I'm different from the mean today in ways that I was different ways than I was a decade ago. So the very concept of the model of the human as an engineering object is just wrong. Engineers love the concrete. And they tend to, I didn't know how many people were going to show up because I'm breaking the premise that you can deal with life as an engineer starting with the premise that everything is concrete, measurable, and stable. You love it in the laboratory. It's just not true if you're going to be a real audio engineer where humans are going to listen to it. They're not concrete. That what they hear depends on their mood, their attentiveness. I mean, you guys could be attending to every word, or you could be daydreaming. That's a cognitive choice that each one of you makes. I'm not in control of that. And furthermore, it's not random. If you just had a fight with your spouse, you may not be unable to attend to what I'm saying. That's not noise. That's intrinsic variability. If you're so fascinated with what I'm saying that you can't think of anything else, that's also dependent on your attitude. If I were to give this lecture to a bunch of basketball players, they'd fall asleep. Why would I average your response in the basketball players in order to get a measure of my presentation? It makes no sense. Okay, so this is one of my favorites. Social spatiality. I'm going to run out of time, but I got to tell you one story about Alan Cobain did a study of 19th century French villages. Why would I have an extensive discussion of French villages? Reason is that in these small villages in this period, citizenship was not a social definition based on somebody deciding. It was not a political, it was not even a formal process. Citizenship in the French town was based on one thing and one thing only. Could you hear the church bells? If you couldn't hear the church bells, you were not part of the town. The church bells served the function of social cohesion, social connectedness. The ears historically were the major vehicle of producing human cohesion among groups of people. And the bells were used for just this purpose. When you had combat and competition between neighboring towns, what they would do is destroy each other's bells. They'd steal each other's bells. The ear is much more important than we recognize, and not just for the purpose of music. It's a social connection. I'll do a couple more digressions. In the late 50s, there was a psychiatrist in England who was studying the elderly population and determined that undiagnosed hearing loss was the major causality of psychosis among the elderly. And in the late 80s, a Stanford physician induced temporary deafness in ordinary listening people and immediately got psychiatric symptoms emerging. And if you talk to the geriatric social workers, they'll tell you, you can lose your vision and you'll bump into things. You can't move around as easily. You lose your hearing, you have to work much, much harder at maintaining your emotional and social equilibrium. In other words, hearing is not just for music and for listening to me lecture. Hearing gives you a connection to people. And unless you happen to be a generation that likes social isolation, which we'll come to later, you got to respect your ears. And even in the musical sense, social cohesion turned out to be the underlying theme of the entire book. Because when I got done with, you know, I don't know what draft, my wife, who became a second author, said, what's the point of this? How does this all go together? And so I redid the whole book, and it became clear towards the end. The critical element is people need people. And our community, audio engineering, music, design of restaurants, which are sometimes, all of that is based on the question, how do you feel about social cohesion? Okay, so these are, let's keep going. Okay. This is oral and visual space don't align. And this is, you take two parabolic mirrors, and you know, you hit this in a typical science museum. From a visual point of view, that people are far away. From an oral point of view, they're very close. So why should I measure distance based on vision? It's not an illusion. It's not a trick. There's an oral distance. There's a tactile distance. There's a visual distance. Why do we assume that vision is the metric we use for measuring? Okay, then I'm going to have to skip the. All right. Social distance has a different set of rules. There's a guy, Professor Hall, who did a brilliant book in the 50s and it called Proximetics, and he came up with four or five concepts of social distance. And you don't like breaking these things. You don't like talking to somebody whom you don't know at a distance, which he calls the intimate distance. And this relates to the acoustics because you may be forced into a different distance in order to accommodate intelligibility, which breaks the social requirements. So if you go to dinner with your boss at a fancy restaurant, but the noise level is so high, the only way you can talk is to be 8 inches from each other, you're going to feel exquisitely uncomfortable because from a social point of view, you should be at the conversational colleague distance, but you're forced to the intimate lover distance based on the acoustic. This is one of the elements in oral architecture, and let me just browse through and see if there's anything that's really worth talking about. This is a slide from Hogarth, who shows how open windows connect spaces together. The Greek amphitheater was interesting because their social requirements were interesting. They had one performance of each show. And if you were anybody in the culture, you had to attend. And so they had to design a space with a sweet spot that would accommodate 20,000 people. There was no second performance. We're going to skip this. This is social symbolic spatiality. This is a religious spatiality. This is a funny one. This was a modern art statue done by Semper in Madrid. He designed it entirely on its visual things. Years later, a bunch of scientists came up. So, you know, this has very interesting acoustic properties, and it's really a multimedia creation. It's got all kinds of interference and very interesting from an oral point of view. But he didn't design it for that. And it illustrated the accidental nature of most of these discoveries. Functional deafness, well, you'll have to go on the web for that. The iPod generation, when these kids put their iPods on, they're deliberately going into another space. It's not the issue when you're driving the car of having hands-free cell phone. It's the fact that when you listen on a headset, you are transported into another space. You become functionally deaf to your own space. And there's a movement, I think, in this city to do away with essentially walking down the street with headphones after three kids got killed because they were in their music space as they barreled across the street. You can't be in multiple spaces, and headphones change the space you're in. Sound has unique properties. This just really pay attention to. You got no earlids. Nature didn't give you earlids. It didn't give you the freedom to stop listening. And that introduces auditory predatory behavior. It induces all kinds of byproducts, which are not true of vision. And there is a predatory group that's coming out with a focus beam loudspeaker, and they're going to couple that with recognition systems. So as you walk down the aisle, a beam of sound is going to approach you and says, aren't you thirsty? Come right here. And they're going to aim this, you know, if it recognizes you're male, it'll use a female voice. And basically, it's auditory stalking. The ear is a very different animal than the eye. I can't really keep you here for 3 or 4 hours. All right. So the final slide is, we're all oral architects. Respect your ears. You're not going to be happy if you blow your ears out. I guarantee it. And if you don't believe me, read some of the literature. It's not just hard of hearing. Your emotional social equilibrium will be disrupted. And the acoustics of the space are part of that. And I guess I'll take a rest and let you ask questions. Who wants to take a pot shot at me? Not your typical talk, so somebody's got something to say. Yeah, that's actually the consistent pattern on all these people who learn to navigate with their ears. The critical predictor was their mother. If their mother was protective, they never learned to use their ears. If they grew up with the support of a parent, and Ray Charles, if you read his biography, is a perfect example, says, go live life. And he said, I'm going to live it to the fullest. Ved Mehta, all these people basically said, I'm going to go live. And that's the I know, given the choice of watching somebody's face or listening to their tone of voice, I'll take their tone of voice every time. There's a certain communication in the sound that you cannot duplicate vision. Somebody else? Anybody fall asleep here?
I have a question. Is there any chance to get your book while we're here?
Oh, I forgot all about that. The Society has got books that they're stocking, and I'm going to go back there and sign those people who actually want my autograph. Don't send it to the bank. It won't cash. But if you'd like to see my name on a first edition, although the book may be a second edition, a second printing by now. Yes?
May I just make a comment there? Some of us would have listened.
Thank you. Actually, it's interesting. Once the book came out and I started emailing and giving these talks, I found incredible pockets of strong interest, almost like people are waiting for somebody to lead them out of the jungle of vision. And it's not quite a critical mass yet, but there are people who really resonate to it. There's a lot more. You go up on the web, which is spacespeak.com, there's a lot of other articles and material. Every time I get something, I put it up if it's relevant. But yes, it's just a vast... In fact, the criticism of the book was not that it's not well written. It's very well... It was edited by a brilliant editor down in Arizona, so it reads easily. It says, nobody's ever written a book where there's one idea per paragraph. Most books are one idea per book, and you get 27 different ways of looking at it. But this book is literally... And my wife said, you're nuts. I mean, who's going to plow through one eye? But it's easy to read. It's just you got to... The one guy, say, puts it on his bedstand, he reads two pages, and then he goes to sleep. That's how he gets through it. Yeah. At the publication, the AES. The AES is handling it, so if you want to get a copy there. The whole point of epistemology is it's the intellectual philosophy of how do you know what you know. And believe it or not, that itself is an intellectual discipline, which has also been split off and fragmented. But it's very much worth your while to get exposed to it. Because if you're young enough and you're in your career and you've learned lots of things, and if I were to say, tell me something you know, and then I would say to you, how do you know it, and what are the assumptions behind what you know, when is it valid to apply it, how strong an inference can you draw from it, you probably wouldn't have any idea what I'm talking about. And yet, philosophically, that was the central intellectual discipline in previous centuries. We've completely forgotten the humility of how do you know what you know. And that's what the epistemology slide. I mean,
I'm afraid we need to let this room transition to its next event. I encourage you to harass Barry immediately outside the hall.
Yeah. I'm going to pack up, hang around the hall, and then go out to the.